May it please the court. My name is Ramsey Rammerman, and I'm here today on behalf of the City of Everett. I'd like to endeavor to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, please watch the clock.
Yeah. The district court erred when it enjoined the enforcement of the city's lewd conduct ordinance based on the vagueness doctrine. The ordinance employed the anatomically correct phrase anal cleft, and a person of ordinary intelligence could readily determine the meaning of that phrase by consulting the text of the statute and a standard dictionary. The district court also erred in enjoining the city's dress code ordinance in this facial First Amendment challenge, primarily because the plaintiffs failed to prove that their conduct qualified as expressive conduct under the Spence analysis. The district court ruled that the lewd conduct ordinance was unconstitutionally vague because the district court was uncertain as to the meaning of the phrase anal cleft. But the Supreme Court has made it clear that there is no certainty requirement in the vagueness doctrine. Instead, the test is whether a person of ordinary intelligence could determine the meaning of the phrase by consulting the full text of the statute and a standard dictionary.
Counsel, how is a reasonable person supposed to know how to interpret that phrase?
If we look at the text of the statute, you readily determine that we're talking about a part of the human anatomy that is associated with the anus and is a vertical opening. We look at the definition of anal and cleft in the dictionary. We know it's obviously associated with the anus and that it is an opening made as if by splitting. There's only one vertical opening made as if by splitting that could be associated with the anus on the human body, and that person could figure that out by looking at these resources. In fact, the record shows that the plaintiff, Giovanna Edge, herself was able to figure out the meaning of this phrase because it is the identical phrase that's used in the Snohomish County Ordinance. And after she was cited for violating this, she was able to instruct her employees how to comply with it. We've also seen that the same phrase is used throughout the country in different jurisdictions, showing that it is an appropriate, anatomically correct phrase, and it passes the vagueness standard.
There's two parts to the vagueness standard. Forgive me for interrupting, but there's the whether a person of ordinary intelligence would understand, basically. And then there's the arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement.
Yes, and here The district court misapplied that standard because that standard goes to problems on determining what is at issue, and the district court merely pointed to problems that the police may have in obtaining evidence to determine whether it was violated.
The difficulty of enforcement as opposed to arbitrary enforcement.
Correct, but when it comes to the, even in the arbitrary enforcement, again, we look at is the standard give the police discretion to determine what a violation is. That here the standard is precise. The problems the district court pointed to was saying that the police might have problems finding evidence. And the United States versus Williams makes it clear that problems in determining whether a ordinance has been violated is not a vagueness issue. Turning to the issue of the First Amendment and the dress code, this is a facial challenge, and the plaintiffs therefore had the burden of proving under Spence that their conduct qualified as expressive. The district court failed to apply the proper Spence standard by failing to require the plaintiffs to meet their burdens under Spence. First, they were required to prove that they were conveying a particularized message.
If nude dancing or lap dancing is expressive conduct, why isn't wearing the outfits not and pouring coffee not expressive conduct? I mean, what message, what particularized message does nude dancing or semi-closed dancing convey?
In Anderson versus City of Hermosa Beach, this court held that nude dancing is exempt from the particularization requirement because it falls into the narrow category of purely expressive conduct. And therefore, by analogizing to nude dancing, the district court, in effect, relieved the plaintiff's burden of their burden of proving any particularization because they have made it clear that they are not engaging in erotic entertainment and shows are banned at the stands. They are simply engaging in standard commercial transactions, and those are not purely expressive.
I
think Judge Akuta's point is really an excellent one, and I struggle with the context here. Because a nude dancer in a cabaret or on a stage is, you know, in that context is doing one thing. And the context here is so very different. This is conduct which involves wearing a garment, a very, very skimpy garment, in a commercial retail establishment where somebody's serving a cup of coffee and there's a tip jar and there's a very different message there, it seems to me. So when I look to Spence, it seems to me there's a message, all right, being sent. by the baristas wearing these costumes, and it seems to me to be entirely distinct from the one that is mentioned in their declarations.
I would agree with that.
What do I do if I think the declarations talk, I think pretty consistently, that wearing these outfits, they think it expresses empowerment, is what the declarations say. And if I think that it's expressive, but the message likely to be received is entirely different.
I think it's incredibly important, under the Spence analysis, there needs to be congruity between the message they're intending to convey and the message the customers are receiving in order to qualify as expressive conduct. I think it's also important to note that there's a good reason that they did not say they were engaging in erotic entertainment. That's because if they did, they would then have to comply with the city's erotic entertainment ordinance, which wouldn't allow this type of business because it has to be completely not visible from the streets and such. So
could I dig a little deeper on this? Because I've really gone back and forth about this message. There are, and we don't make credibility determinations. We have all of these declarations that say that the message that is intended to be sent is one of empowerment, and that women need not be bound up and wear any particular outfit. And it struck me as quite improbable at first. And then I thought about what would have been scandalous in my grandmother's day by way of women's clothing, and you can imagine the continuum. I had a dress code when I was a kid in school, and I couldn't wear pants to school. So there has been an evolution here. And while this seems like a pretty extreme end of the spectrum, it doesn't seem outlandish. So what do I do about that?
Well, I think the role of the Spence analysis and its two elements are both, are they intending to convey a message? And you can believe that they are intending to convey the message they say they're trying to convey. But there also has to be a great probability that your average person is going to understand that message. And the problem with clothing is that it sends a variety of different messages. Someone could wear the exact same outfits and intend to convey a very different message, an erotic message, and so when a message is so variable such as that, it's not going to meet the Spence standard.
Any declarations in the record about members of the public understanding the message that the declarations from the baristas said they were intending to convey?
There's not any evidence from customers showing they understood the message the baristas were intending to convey. The only evidence of the customer reactions are the evidence the city submitted, which are screenshots showing the comments on their photos.
Right. Well, there's also comments. There's a police report that I read where a citizen was complaining very stridently about having witnessed an interaction that was way on the extreme end.
Yes, there's definitely...
That involved touching and whatnot. And so we have that in the record as well, as did the district court.
Yes, there is a lot of evidence on the sexual nature of the conduct that was occurring at these stands. The city council considered...
Not just to get to Judge Akuta's point, it's not just describing the conduct by police officers, but I think citizens as well and their impression, they were appalled.
Yes, there were, I think, something like 40 different citizen complaints reflected in this record in one of the police reports. We had a very strong citizen reaction, which is, of course, why the city council took this action. And going on, even if this is expressive conduct, certainly the city council had the authority to adopt this regulation. It withstands intermediate scrutiny. We have a record here that shows from 7 different law enforcement investigations of 4 different barista stands where this illegal sexually related conduct was occurring and the secondary harms that come from that. And under Alameda, the district court should have deferred to the city council's plausible interpretation of that evidence and its reasonable judgment that there was a link between this business model and the conduct. They had the authority to do that. And I'm already eating into my rebuttal, but just on the issue of the narrow tailoring, the district court also misapplied that standard. I think it's important to note that as the plaintiffs concede in their own briefing, even under the dress code, the plaintiffs in this case remained free to wear a bikini and convey their message almost anywhere in the city, including while serving coffee in a sit-down restaurant. It is a very narrowly tailored restriction that only applies in one location, leaves ample opportunity for them to convey their message in other locations as well. So,
Counselor, can I just quickly, on this narrow tailoring, the district court thought that it wasn't narrowly tailored, and that when we're talking about the dress code as opposed to the lewd ordinance conduct, that the dress code was going to require the baristas to wear more clothing than just about anybody.
It is true that while working at the coffee stands, they'd have to wear a tank top and shorts. But again, when it comes to the issue of narrow tailoring under intermediate scrutiny, the test is not the least restrictive manner. It's merely whether this is a reasonable attempt. It's going to be more effective to affect the law. And the type of line drawing that would come on where how much clothing they would wear is not an appropriate analysis under intermediate scrutiny. We should be deferring to the city's judgment on what is necessary.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Melinda Ebelhair of Benedon and Serlin appearing on behalf of the appellees. I want to start back at the very beginning by simply saying this is an appeal from the grant of a preliminary injunction, and the standard of review is abuse of discretion. And in an abuse of discretion analysis, this Court looks at whether or not the district court applied the correct law and whether or not its findings of fact or its application of law to fact was clearly erroneous. And there's a rather colorful expression that's repeated in our brief about how to determine clearly erroneous finding of fact or application of fact. In this instance...
On the void for vagueness challenges, could we start there? Because those don't involve findings of fact. We're talking about... Well, could we start with void for vagueness?
Sure, Your Honor. Under the void for vagueness standard, there is a notice component, and there is also the arbitrary and capricious enforcement standard. And the U.S. Supreme Court has actually said that the more important test is the requirement that a legislature establish minimum standards to govern law enforcement. That's in Colander versus Lawson, 461 U.S. 352. So here we have a situation where we have a term which, despite the fact, as counsel says, it has been used in a few other reported cases. It's not this exact term that has ever been analyzed by a court. So we have the term anal cleft. Whether or not that is sufficiently determinative for a person of ordinary intelligence to understand exactly what is meant by that might, in fact, be a question of fact. Reasonable person, ordinary understanding. But beyond that, this term is not simply the clear term anal cleft. It is modified by the phrase one half, the bottom one half of the anal cleft. Now, the cleft curves, it's kind of a J curve. How do you measure that bottom half? What does law enforcement have to do in order to determine whether or not the bottom half is covered or not covered? So we have both a notice issue, as in how do I determine the person trying to determine and conform my conduct to this statute, how do I determine where that bottom half is? And then how does law enforcement actually go in and enforce that?
So opposing counsel went straight to Williams, where Justice Scalia said that what renders a statute vague is not the possibility that it will sometimes be difficult to determine whether the incriminating fact it established has been proved, but rather the indeterminacy of what that fact is. So his point is, it says one half, the bottom one half of the anal cleft, and it may be difficult to implement, if you will, and then we rely upon juries to decide whether that fact has been proven, either beyond a reasonable doubt or by a preponderance. But how do you distinguish the Williams case?
Your Honor, I think it's that indeterminate line in there. When you start talking about bottom half or top half, you're talking about generally a straight line. You're not generally talking about a curved line. So I think it's indeterminate exactly where does the line, how does the average person determine what that line is? I think that is... It is so vague. It is difficult. And now you're getting into a question of doing advanced math, I think. It may be possible to determine the bottom half of a J curve.
Well,
I don't know.
In a close case, it might be difficult. I understand that. But a close case, as Judge Kristen says, is what we have juries for. If you're only wearing a G-string and so that the entire bottom is disclosed, then there wouldn't be that sort of problem, would there?
Your Honor, I think I'm not quite completely sure about that because I think it would depend on the covering of the G-string. Obviously, if you're naked and your entire bottom is showing, then that would clearly be a violation. After that, I think you're getting into increments of, well, you know, do I have to cover the curve of the buttock? Do I have to, how do I determine exactly where it is to conform my conduct to?
Okay, do you want to move to the First Amendment issue and why this is expressive conduct? And let me ask the question I asked opposing counsel, which is, are there any declarations in the record from members of the public saying that they understood the message that the baristas said they were attempting to convey?
Your Honor, there are not declarations in the record from members of the public who say that. There are declarations.
There are none.
From the public, correct.
There's no declarations from the public saying they understood the message.
Correct, Your Honor, on this preliminary injunction action. And I respect that that may be something that would need to come into play at trial. But in a preliminary injunction analysis, as the cases do say, that often the evidence is not as robust as we would like it to be for other purposes. There is...
It was my
burden, Your Honor, and there is evidence in the record. There are declarations from Ms. Hernandez and Ms. Ziska, who both testified that they have had conversations with customers who have understood the message and that it has sparked conversations and whatever.
But it has to be the message they intend to convey. That, and what I was positing earlier is there's a message, all right, but what if there's a huge disconnect between what the declarations, and I frankly haven't seen a case like this.
No.
There's just a huge disconnect between what the speaker says she intends to convey and what is very likely to be received. And the Supreme Court does say we have to look at what message is likely to be received.
And yet, Your Honor, in many of the cases, the seminal cases that discuss what the expression must be, we find that part of the reason there is litigation over it in the first place is because the message that is being sent is not understood by the receiver who objects to the message. And we can go all the way back to Spence in that case.
Well, for the symbolic speech, it just seems that the message was not happily received. Like, I don't think anyone doubted what burning an American flag means. There was no issue about that in the case. The question was, could a state criminalize that conduct?
But in the case where it was an upside-down flag with a peace symbol on it.
The court said it was, given the context of the bombing in Cambodia, there was a great likelihood that the message would be conveyed. So I don't remember seeing any concern about the nature of the message for symbolic speech. Opposing counsel says you're not arguing that it's inherently expressive conduct like dance or erotic performance. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I think the message that is here goes beyond, it's not an erotic message.
Forgive me for interrupting, but Judge Akuta's question is a really important one. For starters.
Perhaps I didn't understand
that's
it.
That's okay, but just as a threshold, your brief says very clearly you are not claiming to be engaged in erotic dance.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Forgive me for interrupting, but that's an important point.
And
so this symbolic speech, the conduct, the way you get this to conduct is it's not like the possession of pasties and G-strings was prohibited here. It's the wearing of this very, very skimpy outfit. That is the conduct we're talking about.
And it
the
is
question
wearing...
is what message is likely to be received by that? Forgive me. Go ahead.
And Your Honor, my clients in their declarations time and again say that the message that they are sending is that essentially this is not your mother's coffee stand, okay? That I am not bound by the mores that governed my grandmother, okay? My grandmother couldn't show an ankle in public.
We understand that, and that's what we're trying to get at when we're talking about expressive speech, which is that I don't know of another case where that has involved conduct, speech by conduct, that is expressive, where there has been a disconnect between the message intended to be sent, according to the declarations, and I take them at face value, that they intend to send a message of women's empowerment, and the message likely to be received. As Judge Akuta said, there are other cases where there's a symbolic conduct like burning a draft card, burning a flag, and so forth, and that speech is met with, it is not well received, as opposed to a real disconnect about what does the speaker intend to be saying with this conduct.
Your Honor, I agree that we couldn't find another case that exactly addresses
okay.
the same issues in these cases, and we put quite a bit of effort into trying to find one. But I am, in, in a country with 300 plus million people coming from all different diverse backgrounds and different attitudes, and sadly perhaps in today's society where everything is so polarized that wearing a red hat can create dissension because people are seeing that message differently, and yet I don't think that it would be held that was not protected conduct.
So is wearing a hat that says Make America Great Again conveys a very specific message that anybody looking at it would understand. They're indicating they're a supporter of President Trump and whatever goes with that. So the question here is whether there is any similar conduct. And my concern, and I think Judge Kristen mentioned this, is that the public determined, based on the police reports, the public understood the message to mean I am sexually available or something along those lines, as opposed to anything that the baristas themselves intended to convey.
And, Your Honor, I'm not sure that that's a fair analysis of exactly what the police reports in the record convey.
But we do have to consider conduct. So a woman wearing the very same outfit on a cabaret stage, or frankly wearing a bikini on a beach. On a beach, she may not be sending any message at all.
Correct.
But this is a retail establishment where we understand there's going to be a transaction going on.
And this is a female-owned establishment empowering women to make their own choices. Okay, these women, these baristas are not required by their employer to wear any particular outfit except one, of course, that combines, that meets with whatever decency laws are legitimately applicable. So in this instance, the women are making their own statements about, I can make my choice. I can choose to be in a working environment that is not sexual, it's not a sex business, and I can wear and what I please, and it may be a little bit of kind of in your face.
But what's the evidence? We understand that that's the declaration, say that's their intent, but we need to determine whether there's a great likelihood of that message being understood. So what's the evidence in the record? Where can you point us to showing that it has a great likelihood of being understood by those who view it?
Your Honor, I do go back to the declarations by Ms. Hernandez and Ms. Ziska, where they talk about the reactions they get from their customers. And again, we're looking at an abuse of discretion standard. I don't believe that that's a clearly erroneous finding at the preliminary.
It is a constitutional fact, though. So, but let's back. What if we even give you that and say there's an element of expressive conduct in there that is worthy of First Amendment protection, because I think it is a very unique case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Then what happens? Why wasn't the city free to regulate this as a secondary effect?
Well, Your Honor,
they pointed to a bunch of crime in the area and so forth.
Your Honor, and the police reports and the crime that they point to are the big. Fear factor comes from two owners who were rogue owners. They were criminal. They were running a criminal enterprise and hiding it behind the coffee stand facade. That's not. And they were adequately caught and punished under existing statutes. There was no need to add this additional statute. I think when Your Honor digs down into the legislative record, you see that this was not so much a crime issue. There is, in fact, in the record, I believe it's at ER 778, a report by the City of Everett Police who say, we actually did this study and there's no difference in crime between the adult establishments and the non-adult establishments. And the things that are in the legislative record as an effort to try and bolster the statute are things that, in fact, are not related to secondary effects, even assuming the secondary effects test applies, and see our brief on that issue. They aren't related to secondary effects, they're primary effects. They're worried about the exploitation of the baristas. They're worried about the sexualization message that is sent. These are not.
They were also concerned about sexual assault. They're worried about women working very scantily clad late at night in a remote and isolated location. Why isn't that a legitimate public safety concern?
Your Honor, I think that that is a public safety concern regardless of what women are wearing. Women wear anything, and they're raped and assaulted in this country.
They also mention drug use, in-stand prostitution, public masturbation, exploitation of minors, and X-rated shows were among the various items that were presented to the city council.
And, Your Honor, these were, again, all things that took place with a couple of rogue stand owners who were not actually operating a coffee stand. Qua coffee stand, they
were
operating.
There were police reports about Ms. Edge's establishments, too, that identified the same.
Not about prostitution, Your Honor, not about drug
about
use.
Shows and conduct.
The record reflects that there's a sign up there that says no shows, don't ask. And
does the record reflect that no shows occurred? Because the police report said otherwise.
Your Honor, I would have to go back and look at that specific police report and wonder if it was by what we did have the whole overlay of the problem with deputies in Snohomish County, a deputy who was
co-opted, I think.
Yeah, but who was corrupt? Yes, Your Honor.
I said co-opted.
I'm sorry.
He was working on the undercover investigation, and the allegation is that he was subsequently assisted some of the barista owners. Could I just ask whether or not I know I read about an example of a stand where the women weren't being paid at all, and they were doing this entirely for tips, making it much more likely that they would engage in this kind of very disturbing conduct. Did that involve one of the two people who was convicted?
I believe it did, Your Honor. And again, that has nothing to do with what they're wearing. That has to do with violations of labor laws that happen in any industry in this country, and there are laws that are specifically designed to address exploitation of labor. And whether I don't know that you can tie the fact that we're not going to pay you minimum wage to, oh, and by the way, you're wearing skimpy clothing.
I think the city council did. And doesn't it make it a whole lot more likely that this conduct would be engaged in as opposed to just serving a cup of coffee?
Your Honor, I don't know, and I'm not trying to simply be partisan here. I'm not sure that I see the connection. I've handled a lot of labor cases in my life, from factory workers to I don't know what. I don't think it matters what you're wearing, whether or not your employer is a crook.
Thank you. We took you over your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Addressing the last issue that you're discussing, as far as what was it reasonable for the council to think that this dress code would help? Again, I think it's important to understand that under the Alameda standard that the court was supposed to be applying, he was supposed to defer to the city council's plausible interpretation of the evidence. And the evidence in the record showed not only that there was this problem of the baristas not being paid, but we also showed that, you know, again, the parallels between the business model that was used at these stands and strip clubs, where we see the same type of pressures. Again, even this not paying the baristas and only allow them to work for tips was modeled after things that were done in strip clubs, and that leads to, again, the type of crimes that we see, which is why that's relevant. And we had Lieutenant Duffy, who testified at the second city council meeting on this, of the parallels between the business models that were employed at these stands and that are used at strip clubs, and that thus resulting in the similar crimes.
Opposing counsel says this was primarily limited to the, I think it was Panico and Wilson, to who were subsequently prosecuted, and not to other stands such as Ms. Edge's. Is that correct?
I would disagree with that. I think that what we show here is we investigated four different chains where this conduct occurred, including the Panico and Wheeler, but also Wheeler Senior Stand, and this was prevalent at Ms. Edge's stand as well. The record also shows that more recently we have three independent sources that reference a current stand that's just outside of the city, the Beehive Stands. And we had testimony that this stand has been cited by Snohomish County for nudity. Ms. Edge actually filed a police report on this stand saying they're performing shows and have nudity there. And then the Jane Doe Declaration talked about talking with baristas there who were told that they had, and she was told that the baristas had to have sexual intercourse with the stand owner to get the best shifts. So we see that this business model is susceptible to abuse by the unscrupulous person. The fact that two individuals did it, we don't need to prove Ms. Edge is doing it. What the record shows is that it is readily exploitable by the unscrupulous stand owner. And so that gives the city council had reason to believe that it's readily exploitable based on this record. It was an extensive record. We had, as I said, seven different police investigations, all that uncovered the same type of conduct.
So, counsel, on that point, one option would be to continue to investigate and to continue to prosecute where the conduct steps across the line and really is lewd conduct or is prostitution or something that is criminalized, right? And that would not involve any kind of burden on permissible speech to the extent that there are baristas who really were just selling coffee and wanted to wear this type of outfit. But that comes at a cost, and the city council didn't want to continue to pay those large enforcement bills, I think. Was there any other reason the city chose, in the record that we know of, that the city chose to go this route?
Well, I think the extensive cost of the investigation is not as hard. I don't want to understate that. Sergeant Collier's declaration goes into some level of detail. The city of Everett is dealing with opioid crisis. It's got gang crime. It has to prioritize its resources. And this court has approved that type of consideration. For example, in the Fair Public Progress versus Maricopa County, they allowed the shutting down, the limiting of the hours because of the extra crime that was caused in the late night hours. It was a very valid consideration in trying to figure this out. So the city had a good reason to do that on this record. We also had the issue of the investigation to generate videotapes, and we've had a district court, a superior court, tell us that we have to disclose these videos of naked women to anybody who asks for them under the Public Records Act. And so the city doesn't want to have to generate these videos and the extra costs of that. And that's a necessary step under the current investigative practice, which we can avoid with this dress code ordinance. On the issue of expressive conduct, I just want to stress this is a facial challenge. When this court has looked at conduct, for example, in Thorndike versus King, which was the wearing of a sidearm, the court said that on a facial challenge, that could convey a variety of different things. Yeah, it's shocking to see someone have a gun, but in a facial challenge, it has to you have to prove that everybody's going to get that message. The mere proof that somebody might have interpreted the message correctly alone is not sufficient in a facial challenge based on conduct. Okay. So thus, we ask the court to please vacate both injunctions. Thank you.
Thank you. The case of Joanna Edge versus City of Everett is submitted, and we'll take a brief 5-minute recess.